Secretary of State says Washington will oppose the release of Iran's frozen assets in South Korea until it returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Yemen's Ansar Allah says the U.S. is silent when Yemenis are killed with Western-made weapons, but voices concern when the army is closing to liberating Marib. Also ahead, the UN Security Council condemns Myanmar's military use of excessive force against anti-coup demonstrators. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the U.S. Secretary of State says Washington will oppose the release of billions of dollars in Iranian funds from South Korea until Tehran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Antony Blinken said if Iran comes back into compliance with its obligations under the agreement, the U.S. would do the same thing. He added that the ball is in Iran's court. South Korea said last month that it had agreed on a way to release Iran's frozen money but was awaiting the approval of the United States. Tehran suspended some of its commitments under the nuclear deal after the U.S. withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. Iranian officials have time and again said Washington should lift the restrictions first. Iran's president has slammed the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal for failing to comply with their obligations under the accord. Hassan Rouhani made the remark in a phone call with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Rouhani also touched upon the impacts of U.S. sanctions amid the coronavirus pandemic. He said the sanctions have doubled the problems of coronavirus patients in Iran. He added that the U.S. has not taken any practical measures to revive the nuclear pact. The Iranian president described Washington as the biggest violator of the agreement. The British premier, for his part, said his country, along with the remaining signatories, want to preserve the deal. Political commentator David Yehoubian says the European signatories to the JCPOA remain unable to make decisions independent of the United States.
I think he and the rest of the EU, and particularly if we're talking about the E3 in general, they stand on the fence once again. They are completely unable to engage in independent decision-making, either regarding their own interests or serving the interests of international law and the multilateral institutions that they are members to. And so they continue to just sit on the fence. I believe it's still beneficial that they at least give lip service to the idea of preserving the JCPOA, but beyond that, once again, they're just waiting. Now they're waiting for the Biden administration to make up its mind regarding whether or not it wants to continue with the illegal imperialist policies of the Trump administration, or if it wants to take a new tack, return to the JCPOA, start to heed international law and its treaty obligation.
A former Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency has dismissed as meaningless the so-called step-by-step approach by Washington and Tehran to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Here he is.
What does a step-by-step mean? Because the sanctions are one, and you cannot find equivalent element in our obligations. What do they want? The whole sanction should be removed, and then Iran, as our officials have clearly mentioned and informed, then Iran goes back to where we were. Of course, we have taken steps, gradual steps, after 1 year of strategic patience from according to Article 26. Then Iran goes back. It is very difficult to understand, comprehend what does a step-by-step means.
Sultaniyeh further said that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is continuing the policies of its predecessor against Iran. He added that the U.S. is making a serious miscalculation if it intends to use the maximum pressure campaign as leverage against Iran. He said Washington's return to the deal does not require negotiations, and the U.S. and the EU should not waste time with such propositions. Sultaniyeh, however, stressed that Iran is in no haste for the U.S. to rejoin the deal and has not rolled out a red carpet for it either.
Iran and the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden remain in a standoff over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The U.S. says Iran must take the first step and return to full compliance with the deal. But Tehran says Washington must do so because former President Donald Trump unilaterally walked away from the accord in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions.
Since the U.S. backed out of the deal, it should take the first step. The one that broke the deal must return to it sooner and knows that Iran is ready to fulfill its commitments.
Iran, which began scaling down its JCPOA commitments 1 year after Washington's withdrawal, says its measures are in line with two paragraphs of the accord and in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their obligations. On Wednesday, top Iranian security sources ruled out a step-by-step return to the deal, reiterating that Tehran will hold talks with the U.S. only if it lifts its unilateral sanctions. Speaking to Press TV, they also stressed that Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the U.S. removes its sanctions. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader during a speech last month. Ayatollah Khamenei said during his February speech that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure over its nuclear program and could enrich uranium up to 60% purity if the country needed it. He, however, reiterated that the Islamic Republic will never seek nukes. Now, as Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse the course. This also as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
Tehran says the deal reached between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency is in line with a law passed by the Iranian parliament last year. Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organization stressed that Tehran terminated its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the NPT on February the 23rd, as required by parliament. Kazem Gharibabadi added that Iran will hand over its nuclear facilities records to the IAEA only if all sanctions on Tehran are lifted within the three-month period stipulated in the agreement with the UN agency. Iran's parliament passed a resolution last December that obliges the government to take additional steps to scale back Tehran's commitments to the 2015 nuclear deal. The scale back comes following the remaining signatories' failure to honor their obligations. Iranian and Turkish scholars have come together to discuss human rights violations by the U.S. and its allies across the West Asia. They also blame the U.S. for creating divisions among regional states for its own interests. Bashan Saqlam reports.
The sixth conference of American human rights was held near the Turkish city of Istanbul to discuss the violations of human rights by the United States and the region. The participants stressed that preserving unity among Islamic world is a must in standing against the U.S. and its Western allies' policies, which have only brought death and war to the region.
In this conference, we have tried to discuss the human rights from the point of view of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, as well as the scholars of other countries, including Turkey.
The participants also expressed concerns over the crimes being committed by the U.S. and its Western allies in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, saying the U.S. must be held accountable for the human rights violations.
The conference seeks to introduce the crimes committed by the United States to the international community and the young generation.
The speaker said Iran and Turkey must stand together to stop the U.S. interventions in the region.
The U.S. boasts about defending human rights, but it is the main violator of the rights in the world, particularly in our region. We are here today to show the real face of the U.S. as the main country behind genocides underway in the region.
Unity is the key to preserve Muslim nation against foreign interferences. This has been the main theme of the conference this year. The Iranian and Turkish scholars called for vigilance among regional states to stop the U.S. violence and put an end to its plots in the region. Rahshan Saqlam, SN Yurt.
The leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has accused the United States and the West of having a hypocritical approach towards Yemen. Abdulmalik al-Houthi said Washington and its allies are always quiet when the people of Yemen are killed with the weapons they supplied to some Arab regimes. He said, however, that those very countries express concerns when the Yemeni army is close to liberating Ma'rib and other Yemeni land from Saudi-backed mercenaries. Houthi said the offensive on Ma'rib is aimed at deterring the enemies that have been wreaking havoc and spilling the blood of innocent civilians there for years. The Ansar Allah leader also accused the United States of hatcheting plots to target his country, just like it did with Iraq and Afghanistan. He slammed Israel and the West for propagating the Takfiri terrorism with the aim of gaining control in the region. Meanwhile, hundreds of health facilities across Yemen are on the brink of collapse due to the Saudi blockade and lack of fuel. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion has warned that it can no longer store blood stocks. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washari, has more.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma, and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeidah and LBB have stopped their operations, and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country.
International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The UN Security Council has slammed Myanmar's military crackdown on peaceful anti-coup protesters. The Council's 15 member states said they strongly condemned the use of violence against the protesters, including women and children. The Council also called on the military to exercise utmost restraint and emphasized that it is following the situation closely. Meanwhile, several anti-coup protesters were injured in fresh clashes with security forces in the city of Yangon. The Southeast Asian nation has been in turmoil since the military overthrew the government of Aung San Suu Kyi on February the 1st. The military complained of fraud in the November 2020 election. More than 1,000 Greek students take to the streets of the capital Athens to protest police violence. The rally comes a day after a similar march led to clashes with security forces. During Tuesday's violence, over a dozen people were arrested and 10 officers were hurt, including one with serious head injuries. The rally witnessed 200 hooded protesters throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at police. They responded with tear gas and water cannon. The recent uproar comes after the release of the video that went viral, showing an officer beating a man to enforce a coronavirus lockdown. Political commentator Stavros Mavroudis says the recent uproar in Greece is partly driven by the economic downturn in the country.
These events are the result of the accumulated popular anger against the right-wing government and its policies. Its policies can be codified in two things. First, economic policies in favor of big capital, and second, authoritarianism and police repression. Even official statistics published yesterday recognized that there is an approximately 9.6% fall in GDP in 2020. Of course, these are probably Marshall statistics. The real extent of the recession is approximately 12%, which is a huge. Now, the fiscal support provided by the government is very limited.
The Democratic-held U.S. House of Representatives has approved President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 stimulus package. Under the new relief plan, one of the largest in U.S. history, most Americans will receive direct payments of up to $1,400. The package also extends unemployment benefits, aid to local governments, and funding for vaccine distribution. The relief package received zero support from Republican lawmakers, who argue the measure is too costly and wasteful. The bill passed. The bill is now awaiting Biden's signature to be enacted. According to reports from U.S. media and the government itself, thousands of unaccompanied migrant children are being housed in the Customs and Border Protection Office facilities. The number of these children has increased significantly over the past weeks, despite claims by the new administration to tackle the problem. Ronnie Corvello brings us more with this report.
What once counted in the hundreds of children who remained in the Border Patrol hands when they were cruelly separated from their parents by the Donald Trump regime, now they are counted by the thousands. The number tripled in just a few weeks. According to the internal CBP report, there are more than 3,400 unaccompanied migrant children in cages.
It might be a big problem in the immediate future, like meaning in this couple of months ahead of us. But it's certainly not the main headache as it relates to immigration, because as we know, the problem is much more complex, and it's a problem that he inherited, not from the precisely from the Trump administration, but from years of a broken system that has not been fixed.
What is happening on the United States border was ignored for several days by President Biden's administration, even publicly refusing to accept that they are facing a humanitarian crisis. Still, according to witnesses, this is how they address the issue internally.
It is a humanitarian crisis because every time we deal with groups that migrate and you are not able to accommodate them, the numbers, the volume, it becomes a humanitarian crisis by definition of what a crisis is. However, if we hear carefully, the Biden administration is not labeling a crisis. The word crisis is coming from the conservative, the Republican Party, because the more you label it a crisis, it will give more ammunition from the right to say, you can't solve it.
Aside from being detention cages that is not designed for children, a report indicates that they are sleeping on benches as there are no beds. According to government data, 9,000 migrant children crossed the border in February, but now thousands more are waiting on the Mexican side. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Corvello.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The Biden administration begins a military posture review. A quick look around the world shows how badly American posture needs revision, says Doug Bando, author, in an article titled, Time for U.S. to Bring Troops Home. Stay tuned for more. A new president, a new policy review. Such is the way of Washington. The Biden Defense Department announced a global posture review, that is, a reassessment as to how much of the role the U.S. military plans to occupy, with or without other nations' consent in coming years. Pentagon Press Secretary John F. Kirby put a positive spin on the exercise, explaining that this review will help inform the Secretary's advice to the Commander-in-Chief about how we best allocate military forces in pursuit of our national interest, unquote. However, this presumes that America's political and military leaders have a reasonable and rational understanding of U.S. national interest. Unfortunately, that has been absent for years. Today, foreign policy is dominated by a bipartisan clique which believes that America's default position should be to intervene. In this view, the U.S. is a geopolitical staff possessing the world's conscience and determined to eliminate evil and redeem the sinners worldwide. As Madeleine Albright once declared, America stands taller and thus sees further. So it is entitled to run the world with brutal military force if necessary. Globe-spanning military deployments like today naturally follow this philosophy. The Defense Department believes it should station troops wherever they are welcome and often where they're not. Naturally, the wishes of other nations are ultimately irrelevant. Their duty is to obey their betters in Washington. The U.S. must go through a pretense of consultation, since it is sometimes necessary to pacify the natives, as it were, but even former alliances are never equal partnerships. If the Biden administration undertakes its review with this philosophy, it shouldn't waste its time or the taxpayers' money. In contrast, imaginary thinking of U.S. military deployments with the recognition that Washington's highest duty is to protect the American people, their lives, lands, and liberties. Verboten would be using war and the threat of war to engage in international social engineering. Make the world safe for absolute monarchy, join random civil wars, launch ivory tower crusades, seek commercial advantages, remake foreign societies, provide defense welfare to wealthy countries, subcontract policy to favored foreign clients, and buy off domestic interests. Despite the hysterical rhetoric that fills Washington, we are living at the most dangerous moment of human history. Probably the most fearsome time in the entire cosmos, now and forever into the future, and maybe even worse. Most other countries could be disrupted or conquered, and Americans would barely notice. Consider Afghanistan. Central Asia is as far from the U.S. as one can imagine, and is bound by Russia, China, Iran, India, and Pakistan. There is no more ludicrous location on Earth for Washington to fight an endless war, especially for the purpose of creating a Western-style democracy and strong central government where they never before existed. Indeed, the last two decades showcase how promiscuous war-making is likely to have anything but humanitarian results. Particularly important is recognition that most of what Washington officials count as threats do not endanger America, but rather allied states. Beijing's objective is to prevent the U.S. military from dominating its territory and adjoining waters. In essence, China wants its own Monroe Doctrine, keeping Washington out of Beijing's affairs. No Chinese naval task force will be descending upon Honolulu or Los Angeles. If there is war between China and America, it will be in Asia, not the Western Hemisphere. As for America's allies, they could do far more. Japan worries about its control over the Senkaku Islands, also claimed by China, but spends just 1% of its GDP on defense. The Philippines makes even less pretense of arming itself, preferring to rely ostensibly on Washington. Similarly, North Korea threatens the U.S. only because the latter's military forces are over there. Pyongyang understands Washington's power to do damage and has no interest in war with America. Which is why the Kim government wants nuclear weapons as a deterrent to attack. As for South Korea, it enjoys a 50-to-1 economic advantage and 2-to-1 population advantage over the North. The former is well able to defend itself. Moscow certainly has no interest in war with America. Indeed, the US and Russia have no dispute over critical interests like territory. Europe lacks on military spending because it doubts the threat and relies on America, because not it lacks the necessary resources. Seeing this world clearly, where should U.S. forces be deployed? To start, there should be fewer of them, especially army divisions. There is no good reason for Washington to promise to defend its prosperous, populous cousins across the pond. Certainly, America need not field an army to protect manpower-rich Europe. Washington should also stop entering other nations' endless wars, including Yemen, and engaging in endless nation-building as in Afghanistan. Cutting back these misadventures and similar future commitments would allow the U.S. to further reduce force structure and military outlays. As for deployment of its remaining forces, Washington should transform alliances in which America does the heavy lifting to cooperative relationships where countries work together toward common security ends. That means access to essential facilities with skeletal crews rather than an extravagant network of hundreds of bases with tens of thousands of combat personnel. Such should surely be the case in Europe and West Asia, North Africa region, and in other parts of Asia too. Although in the latter the threat to America's friends is greater, China has demonstrated little interest in regional conquest. The result of such a policy would be a radically shrunken global posture, but one focused much more on the interests of American people. Joe Biden has spent a half century promoting the U.S. as a perpetually interventionist power. In today's world, that approach fails to safeguard core American interests, nor is promiscuous war-making affordable, given Washington's rapidly rising debts and expanding domestic responsibilities. Joe Biden should use the ongoing Pentagon review to begin charting a new course.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us listen to a thought-provoking saying from the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him. For the steadfast, a misfortune is only one, while it is twofold for the impatient.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم and welcome to the program The Man Who Changed the World. I'm Sayed Jabari, here with our guest speaker Dr. Mehdi Torabi, an expert and Islamic researcher. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Today we have a quote from Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, where he says, superpowers want to suppress the humanity of humans. You know, what do you make from that?
It's
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is related to what we were speaking in the previous program about Imam Khomeini. We ended by saying that, you know, basically Imam was there to build, as all Muslims are supposed to, as all the religious leaders, whether it's Masum or Ghayr Masum, are there to build humans. And a real human being doesn't accept oppression, doesn't accept to be dominated, doesn't accept injustice, doesn't allow himself to be oppressed. And this is one of the things that Imam used to tell us during, at the beginning of the revolution and as part of the struggle for the establishment of the Islamic Republic, is that they are really, that the dominating powers, whether it's Taghut, the governments within the Muslim countries in Iran, or their supporters, they don't want people to be real human beings. They want them to be, you know, in a way, creatures that are completely at the service of their lowly desires, who will be consumers of their products, who will be, you know, willing agents and executioners of whatever it is that those taghut and those powers want them to do. That they will not be liberated humans, that they will not be educated, that they will remain ignorant. And this relates to what we were talking about before, about how this revolution and how the Islamic Republic has so fundamentally transformed the lives of so many people in Iran for the better. Mm-hmm. From going from a very feudal, illiterate society, the majority of the people, considering even that glorious history, that you would have, you know, even, you know, 5% or 10% of the population living in that state that they did it at the time of, you know, the previous regime. But it wasn't just 5 or 10%, it was, you know, the vast majority. It was 70, 80% of the people who were like that. And so basically what Imam was talking about is that this America, these Western powers, don't want us to be real human beings. And this is related to what we were talking about in, and what's been going on in the news.
Yes.
Which is that, you know, when we're talking about having discussions with the West or with the Americans, and as the Supreme Leader has pointed out so many times, is you have to understand the nature of who you're dealing with. It's not about getting together for, you know, a few rounds of talks and that's it. You might do that on specific subjects, on very specific matters. But you cannot lose sight of the nature of who you're dealing with. And who you're dealing with, the way he says here, are powers and are people who don't want us to be real human beings. They don't want us to have knowledge.
This is why we see, like, Western superpowers with such an opposition to, you know, Islam and to an Islamic government and Islamic state, because, you know, Islam in reality is a religion of submission by definition, you know, but it's a religion of building humanity.
Exactly.
You know, it's submission to God, but it's a religion of building humanity. And, you know, the great alims, you know, that were during the revolution, that, you know, these Western superpowers were assassinating left and right.
Exactly.
You know, were telling us this, like Ayatollah Mutahhari.
Exactly.
You know, the, you know, great friend and, you know, colleague, you know, and companion of, you know, Imam Khomeini. You know, he was telling us, you know, there's two types of freedom. You know, the West is constantly shouting, you know, freedom, freedom, freedom. Yeah. You know, we have freedom, you don't. But, you know, they don't even know what freedom is.
Exactly.
You know, he's telling us, you know, there's spiritual freedom, you know, and there's a physical freedom. You know, man is a complex, you know, being.
Exactly.
You know, we have lust, we have desires, we have anger, we have envy, you know. If a person cannot control his own spiritual freedom, how can we expect a man to, you know, respect the freedom of his neighbors,
exactly,
or his, you know, his other people in the society?
Exactly. And that's exactly the point, is that, you know, when you're dealing with these people, know the real nature of what they want.
Yeah. And Islam teaches us these things,
right,
and this is why they oppose Islam.
You know, just think about this for a second. So, through all these difficulties and sanctions and all that, we have young scientists in this nation who are able to solve the most complicated issues relating to advanced technologies. For example, they said, you know what, we're not going to give you any more these fuel plates. So
so that you can have the medical reactor for all the people that require nuclear medicine when it comes to cancer. So it's about 800,000 people. They said, you know what, we're not going to give it to you. Very simple, very straightforward. We're not going to give it to you. We're just going to let hundreds of thousands of people die just to show you that we have the power and you need to submit to us. And what happened? What did the Iranians do? They built it themselves. And then what did the Americans do? They killed the guy who did it.
Yeah.
Which was the nuclear scientist that they assassinated. Okay? So, this is what we're talking about. I mean, why would you do that? Why would you do that? He's a scientist. He's helping
medicine,
hundreds of thousands of people to survive. These are mothers, fathers, these are, you know, brothers, sisters, children.
Yeah,
why would you do that?
The West, you know, they're always talking about, you know, helping humanity, you know, sending relief and sending aid to these countries and those countries. But, you know, under the table, they're saying, you know, if you don't follow us, you know, we're not going to help you. You know, you guys can just
rot. We're
not going to
help you. We're going to kill you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you try helping yourselves, you know, we're going
to... So they're going to kill you anyways. So, you know, when we say or when Imam says this, and he said this, whatever, almost 35 years ago, he's saying things that are reality. They're the facts on the ground. They are the historical, you know, experience that we have with these people. Okay? Why shouldn't the Iranians be able to have nuclear medicine with their own power? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that?
Most of the other, you know, advanced countries in the world, they have it. You know, Japan has it. You know, all
these
other
countries. What's wrong with us having the ability to produce fuel plates to power our research reactors in order to have nuclear medicine for people who have cancer? What's wrong with that? Is there a problem with that? Do you have a problem with that? Obviously, you have a problem with that. So if you have a problem with that, that means you are, you know, inhumane. You are not a human being. You're an animal. You're somebody who has so much evilness inside of you that you cannot bear to see other people being happy and successful and healthy. What kind of a spiritual disease must you have to be like that? And this is the point. So, you know, we're dealing with people who have major spiritual diseases, who are dangerous people. Dangerous not in the sense that we should be scared, but these are people who, you know, whatever good there is, they will destroy it just for their own animal desires. Okay? Now, the interesting thing is in the Quran, it says that they're worse than animals. That's what the Quran says. Why? Because an animal will eat or, you know, attack another animal and eat to them to the amount that is required. He won't go out and, you know, gratuitously kill another six, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a pack of lions won't just
kill
go
a whole herd of zebras for nothing.
Right, just gratuitously. You know, we're full now. Let's just prove to them that, hey, you know, we can do this. that's not what animals do. Animals, their own nature is limited to the extent that they can do that, and they are just in their own way. But these things, they're worse than animals. They're willing to see thousands and thousands of children die, and they did it in Iraq, and they've done it in other places, so it's not like we're anything new, you know? They did it in Afghanistan, they're doing it on a daily basis in Pakistan, you know? And Vietnam,
whatever. And the
problem is,
little by little, they're, you know, brainwashing the society, you know? It's not just like the superpowers, the people in charge, you know, little by little, they're putting these movies, they're putting, you know, these video games.
Right.
You know, and they're brainwashing, you know, kids from a young age through these cartoons and these video games. You know, it's no big deal.
Exactly. So you dehumanize others, and when you do that, you dehumanize yourself. And so you end up being worse than an animal, as the Quran says. So what we're dealing with these people in our negotiations with them, and, you know, nobody's against negotiations, but, you know, you have to know who you're dealing with. And their goal, as Imam Khomeini said so many years ago, is they want to take the humanity away. That means you become an animal, and that means you then become something that they can manipulate and kill and destroy and have complete control over, as they desire, based on their interests, whether it's their material interests or whether it's status or whatever it is. So, I think it's good to look back because what Imam used to say about these things was always on target and was Quranic. I mean, you know, Imam used to, what he used to say was Quran. I mean, he used to say it in a different way, but the base of it, the substance of it, was Islam and was Quran. And one of the problems we have in the Muslim communities is that we are distant from Quran. And I'm not trying to, you know, say a cliche, oh, read your Quran or whatever. I'm not even talking about that. Because, you know, we actually do read the Quran. But we don't reflect on its wisdom. We don't reflect on what it's actually telling us. We recite it as though it's a song. We like the way it sounds. And because it's the word of God, it has some effect on us. So this is not some, I'm not against that. I'm not one of those, whatever, Puritan type. You know, read the Quran, do tajweed, do tati, that's good, it's beautiful. But the important part is to reflect on what it says. And it's interesting, if you actually read the Quran, you will see that it is the most hardcore thing ever. It says things in a very hardcore way. It's not one of those things that really tries to, you know, hide things or
beat around the bush
or whatever. It really just says it the way it is. And I would recommend, and I begin with myself always, to spend more time reflecting on what the Quran says. Even if it's, you know, one short surah, if you spend time knowing that on a deeper level, that's better than if you read the whole Quran and not really, you know, do it in a surface way. Exactly.
Like we have the hadith that says, you know, an hour of, you know, reflection, an hour of contemplation is worth, you know, 70...
Exactly, and I think one of the best, exactly, that's exactly the tafakkur. And I think the best, one of the best examples of tafakkur is reflecting on the Quran. And it's not, you know, because unfortunately, when we, in English, when we speak about religion, there's so much baggage coming from Christianity and Bible and all that, that we sometimes misunderstand what we're saying. We're not talking about, you know, the term fundamentalist, you know where that comes from. That comes from late 19th century U.S., you know, some of the Christian groups literally...
To get back to the fundamentals.
Right, and the literal interpretation of the Bible. So, you know, and then suddenly they say Islamic fundamental. Well, what does that mean? First of all, the Quran is not like the Bible. It's not the same thing. Right? I mean, these are different things.
Anybody who has read, you know, even a small part of either one, you know, can see that.
Right. So the Quran itself is a living thing. Do you understand? It's not a book. It's called Kitab, but in Arabic, Kitab, you know, doesn't just mean book.
Yes.
Okay. So Kitab, it's a Kitab, but not Kitab in like other books. It's a living thing. It has its own soul. It has its own nur. You know, it's a being. It's an actual being.
Yeah. It has you know, it is from God, but it's a creation of God. And it becomes a little bit complex, you know, topic to get into, but it will actually give witness on a day of judgment.
Exactly, it's
a
being. It exists. It's a being. You can't just say that beings are just humans and plants and, you know, jinn and whatever, angels. The Quran itself is a being. It has a reality of its own. You know? So, when you reflect on the Quran, you're doing that which... you know, your soul was designed to do. You know, God created you. You're the soul that God, you know, He breathed into of Himself. Mm-hmm. Your soul is directly from God. He breathed that soul into a body. That body will leave one day. This, you know, will become dust when you die, inshallah, when, you know, we're very old and had a wonderful life. But that soul will still be there because that soul is eternal. It's with God. It comes from God, it goes to God. Mm-hmm. And what you need to do in whatever time you have and whatever opportunity and chance that you are going to get is you need to, you know, get that soul with the Quran. Okay? And when you do that, you can see the effect that it has on your soul. And you will see it exactly as you said, that, you know, in the grave. It's not even on the Day of Judgment, in the grave. We have many rivayat where, you know, people are going to be in the grave the night of the, when they first go into the grave, and then they'll see this wonderful creature and being coming, and they'll be like, who's this? And it was like, I'm the Quran. And, you know, you
recited me and you remembered me, so I'll remember you today. Okay? So, that's the point. The point is that as a human being, and which is a soul, which is an eternal soul, you have to be connected to the Quran. And this is when somebody like Imam comes around. And this is one of the beautiful things about Imam. And Supreme Leader has talked about this as well. He did in the recent speech, mm-hmm. again. That one of the great things about Imam was is that he was very direct.
Yes.
He was very direct. Like the Quran is. You know, we have this one ayah. We've talked about this before, but it's really worth mentioning. It's, you know, who's the most beloved of Allah? It's the Prophet, peace be upon him. Who's the peak of creation? Who's, you know, the newer that, exactly. you know, enlightens all of creation. And you know what he says to him? He says, if you don't convey the message precisely as I have given it to you, I will cut your throat. This is Allah talking to the Prophet.
Yes, and we see, you know, that, like, you know, God, he created, you know, we have the Rivayat, you know,
right.
that God, he created the Prophet's, you know, spirit first.
Right.
And then he created, you know, all of existence because of that spirit, you know,
exactly.
for the sake of that spirit.
Exactly. So what we're
so
talking about,
surety, you know,
and then
the
so this is
the
this
most
is
beloved.
Right. And so to him, he says, you know, what's important is that you convey what I tell you precisely.
Yes.
Because it's about this program called Islam. Islam's a program. It's a program for perfection.
It's a program for humanity.
It's a program for perfection, whether it's a person, whether
yes.
it's a family, whether it's humanity. And we've talked about this before,
exactly.
but it's good to review all this stuff again, which is that, okay, so we say Allah is perfect, right? I mean, that's what makes you Allah, right? that's what distinguishes God from
everything
else. Right?
Exactly.
Is that he's perfect. So would something that's perfect have an imperfect way of conveying his message? Is that even conceivable? Is that even conceivable?
Exactly.
It's not even conceivable. People say, no, it's conceivable. I'm saying, it's not conceivable.
That's
by the
a little bit of the problem with Christian doctrine. You know, they believe that the prophets were, you know,
right.
you know, able to commit sins. You know, even now we say, some of the Sunnis are saying that the prophet was not infallible. You know, he could commit sins.
Right.
You know, is that conceivable that the prophet,
is it
you
even
know,
conceivable that
could make a mistake
that
in
the perfect,
delivering God's
something
message?
That's perfect would have, by the very definition of perfect, it means that what he does is perfect. Otherwise, he's not perfect. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did not convey his message perfectly, he wouldn't be perfect. Perfect is an all-encompassing concept.
Yes.
There's no exception to it. You can't be perfect except for, you know, on Tuesday, right? You're either perfect or you're not perfect.
Yes.
Okay? This is the problem. And you know, it's hard. It takes time. It takes maybe some years to really for things to sink in. Of course, you know, I mean, I'm not saying I'm an exception to this, but think about this. So we say Allah is perfect. So how can he be not be perfect? Is there any way you can conceive any place where he's not perfect? You can't. That means his message is perfect. The messenger is perfect, and the message is perfect. You
exactly.
can't have the perfect with a capital P, if we're going to call Allah that, the perfect, sending a perfect message with an imperfect messenger. It's impossible.
You know, against logic.
It's inconceivable. It's not only illogical, correct, as you say, it's inconceivable. By the very definition of perfect, it means everything is perfect. All its parts and its, you know, consequence, everything's perfect.
Because then we'd always have to be in doubt. It's like, okay, now if the prophet is, you know, fallible, you know, okay, maybe he made a mistake here.
Exactly.
Maybe,
and,
you know, he
you
mixed this up.
And I'll tell you something, brother. Even Shia Ahlul Bayt don't understand this properly.
Unfortunately.
Yes? Not all of them, but a lot of them. She's like, well, what happened? So what about, you know, the succession and all that? I'm like, please. You know? Please, you know? So, it's perfect. Okay? Now, a person like Imam comes around every couple centuries and just, you know, explodes. You know, comes and says it the way it is, the way the Quran says it. And it has to do with humanity, with being a human being, that divine definition of human being. And you see all of it whenever, and it's like you know, the reason we're saying these things is so that people, when they're confronted with new issues and with news, with something new happening, that they understand it and can put it in the right context. So just look at the way these powers and these enemies of Islam, every year they come up with new tricks and new policies and new strategies to try to weaken Islam and the Muslims and, you know, the Islamic Republic. You know, it's always about decreasing that our humanity, whether it's trying to get us towards a more kind of perverse culture where things that are related to our lowly desires are the focus.
Which you see in the Western society.
Which is what the West is.
What are they doing there, you know?
Right, and it's all about
promoting, you know.
It's all that, right? I mean, you know, we've lived there. We know what it is. And when you're in it, it's so prevalent that sometimes you don't even realize it. It's so part of everyday life, whether it's on the TV, whether it's, you know, on the street, whether it's, you know, in interactions.
It started off subliminal, you know, little this, little that, and now it's like, you know, right in front of our face, you know, a giant billboard, you know.
Right, and we don't even think about
some explicit material, and we're just like...
And you know, the point of that is, and remember, people are like, oh, you guys are prudes or whatever. No, it's about why do you have to use that to sell, you know, some product? What does that have to do with that?
Exactly.
It has to do with the fact that that person who's trying to sell you that whatever, you know, worthless product that you don't really need, the way he's trying to sell that to you is to appeal to your lowest desire.
Now it, like, doesn't even matter what you're trying to sell. Just putting, you know, unmodestly dressed woman, you know, holding that product, and there's your advertisement.
Exactly. Or the idea that, you know, make money and, you know, you can be a billionaire and you can be a millionaire and all that. And it's gotten to the point where you have these, you know, these so-called preachers talking about, you know, whatever wealth gospel and, you know, and, you know, they're talking about Jesus and they have like six private jets. Like, that, do you know who Jesus is?
Yeah,
do you
Jesus
know how he lived?
Saying, you know, sell your possessions.
Do you know how
you
he lived?
To the poor. You know, if you want to follow me, you know, sell your possessions.
You know we have
feed the hungry.
We have one of these famous sayings by Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, you know, talking about Prophet Jesus, Isa alayhi salam, he said he used a rock as his pillow and he used the stars as his blanket. And then we have Rivayat. He's by the river. This is a Rivayat from Ahlul Bayt about Hazrat Isa. You know, he's by the river and he's combing his hair and his beard. And then a stranger comes by the river and, you know, puts his hand in the river and uses his fingers to comb his his hair and his beard, and he takes his comb. Hazrat Isa takes his comb and throws away his comb because I don't need it. Okay, so now you know, in the name of Jesus, they're driving, you know, Bentleys and
exactly
have you know, million-dollar mansions.
You know, there was this one like story my dad told me. You know, this woman, she had one child, and right. She, you know, she was, you know, a widower, and she married, you know, a new man.
Right.
And he had like 9 kids.
Right.
So what does she do? She feeds all the 9 kids first. And then tells all of them, give half of your food to this one. So now her one kid got more food than all of them.
Right.
So what do we see now in, like, the churches and stuff? These pastors are saying, you know, all you people, give me 10% of your, you know, incomes.
Right.
You know, you...
And,
you know,
and it's interesting because you mentioned that, because then people turn around and be like, oh, you guys, Shias have homes, right? And we're like, excuse me, have you seen how...
much the homes is?
No. Have you seen how much... Do you see how Imam Khomeini lived?
Oh, that's one thing. Yeah, that's another.
I mean, that's the whole
it.
Point. In Shia Islam, you're not allowed to be a wali.
This comes is, you know, the imam's money. You know,
it's
going
not
the to
personal
the poor.
Money.
It's
yeah,
going
it's not,
to, you know,
right. It's not your personal
of
money.
Islam.
It's not your personal money. So if you look at the way, for example, Imam lived, who, you know, had tens of millions of dollars at his service, but how did he live? He lived in a 50-meter, you know, one-room apartment.
Yeah. He was eating, you know, food more simpler than mine and yours.
Right. And the beautiful thing about Islam is, especially the Ja'fari school, is that if you want, we've talked about this before, but it's always good to, you know, repeat some of these things, that one of the conditions for being wali, mm-hmm. whether it's wali of a nation, whether it's wali of a neighborhood, of a city.
Person in leadership.
In a leadership position is you have to live like